Aleichem Malachei HaShoret.
During World War II, my grandfather, Charles Capel, was interred at Fort Brendonck in Brussels for 11 months in 1941 and 1942.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Dr. Ezra Capel, professor of Jewish Studies and professor of English at the College of Charleston, about the letters his grandfather sent to his fiancée, Isa, from a prison camp in Brussels.
My grandfather's story of suffering and survival, with its starts, stops, and infuriating circumlocutions, often eerily echoed the biblical stories which structured my earliest childhood memories, as surely as the pictures of my great-grandparents murdered at Auschwitz frames every morning and evening of my grandmother's existence.
Letters from Brendonck with Dr. Ezra Capel on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Ezra Capel, who teaches and publishes in the field of 20th century and contemporary Jewish American literature. He's the author of the critically acclaimed book, American Talmud, The Cultural Work of Jewish American Fiction, and he frequently lectures on Jewish American culture and Holocaust writing. His new project is called Letters from Brendonck.
This is where my project, Letters from Brendonck, might help complete the picture. It just might fill in the fissures and gaps in the story of the thousands of Jewish victims of Fort Brendonck.
Jewish literature scholar, professor, writer, Dr. Ezra Capel, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Brett.
So why don't you start by setting up this story that you called Hide and Seek in Rigolo Park?
So I started writing this book when I was a grad student back at NYU in the mid to late 1990s, I guess. And it's sort of an amazing story how I started to do this work, which is that I'd always heard about the Holocaust. There was never a family simcha or gathering, a joyous occasion in which we wouldn't be celebrating my bar mitzvah, my cousin's bar mitzvah, a bat mitzvah, a wedding, an anniversary, Thanksgiving, you name it, Hanukkah, whatever the celebration was, we'd all be together and we'd all be having a good time. But at some point, there would have to be a moment in which the Holocaust was invoked, in which the awful suffering of the past would come and rear itself into the midst of our celebration. And in some ways, this is just, right? This is sort of how it should be. We can have it no other way. This is our reality. And in many ways, this is in keeping with Jewish tradition, which says that no matter what joyous occasion you have, you're supposed to keep the destruction of Jerusalem and place that above your highest joy, it says in Psalm 137. So that is why we break a glass, for example. It says, Imishkachech Yerushalayim tishkach yimini. My right hand should wither and my tongue should cleave to my palate. So you have to raise the memory of the destruction of Jerusalem above your highest joy. And so in a way, my grandparents were only doing what is taught us through thousands of years of exile and Jewish tradition. And yet, despite that being the case, as a child, it's something that we knew. All of the cousins and myself, we all knew about this, but we didn't really know about it. If you had asked me when I was 25 years old about the names of the camps my grandfather was in, I couldn't have really told. I knew maybe Brendonck, I might have known. I don't think I knew Mechelen, Malines. I really didn't know the specifics about it. And I was very close in college. I'm still good friends with a writer friend of mine. Her name is Natalie Stina Harnett. And she is the daughter of an ethnic German family that came to America because they were fleeing Hitler, because they were dissenters of Hitler and were forced to leave Germany and came to America. And she is an adoptee and had spent much of her life trying to discover what she could. New York has closed adoption laws, and she was trying to find out all that she could about her birth parents, which had taken her years and years and years to get information. And she was the one who urged me and said, here I am spending all of my time and whatever meager money she had to try to find information about her birth parents. And here you have your grandparents living in Queens and in good health, and you are not getting their story. You have all of this information that you can get that you need to have, and you're not doing it. And she urged me really like weekly, why haven't you done this? Have you gone out there to interview them? And I was living in Manhattan in the East Village at the time, and I pushed it off because I knew how traumatic it was going to be. And by that point, my grandfather's health had begun to suffer. He had a series of small strokes called TIAs, and he wasn't doing so well. And so I finally decided that I needed to do this. This was something I really had to do. And I both really wanted to do it, but also really didn't want to do it. And I took, you know, several subways. I think it was three trains out there on a very hot July day, and began the process, which my grandparents both agreed to, but then also didn't really want to do either. So it was like all of us sitting together in a room, both wanting to be there and not wanting to be there.
What I shall tell you now is the story how I got into the camp, when I got into the camp.
Yeah, which name was that one?
The camp?
Yeah.
The name of the camp was Brendonk.
Brendonk.
B-R-E-N-D-O-C-K.
Mm-hmm. Brendonk.
Brendonk.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the famous camps, the German camps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I will start with the story how I got into this camp.
Mm-hmm.
So would you provide us some background on Fort Brendonk and its use as a Nazi concentration camp during World War II and the Holocaust?
Yeah, so Brendonk is a fascinating, and really, in some ways, I see it as a microcosm for the futility of all wars, really. Perhaps that's a naive statement, but when you learn about Fort Brendonk's history, you sort of have to think in those terms. So Fort Brendonk is the last of a series of, I think it's about 14 or 15 forts that were built starting in around 1871 and didn't conclude till the beginnings of the 20th century. And these were a series of large fortifications that were built to protect the Belgians from any outside invaders, the French, the Germans. But it took about half a century for them to finish these fortifications. And by the time the project was completed, they were basically obsolete. And the different types of weapons being used for warfare, these forts were not effective at all. In fact, you know, when the invading armies, they would just say, oh, okay, you know, we'll just go a mile away this way, and you'll have to keep this fort filled with thousands and thousands of soldiers. And so not only didn't it help them, but it was actually a hindrance to the defense of Belgium. And so this particular fort, which is incredibly hideous looking, kind of looks from a bird's eye view like some sort of a hideous crab on the face of the earth with these tentacles and these arms kind of sticking out on all sides of it. And it was a place that during the Nazi occupation of Belgium became a prison camp, a punishment center, and a concentration camp really for political prisoners and for Jews. And my grandfather was both of those. And so he was sent there, and it was one of the most notorious camps throughout the German camp, the Nazi camp system throughout occupied Europe. It was one of the most vicious camps run by an incredible sadist in Philipp Schmidt, who thought of incredibly horrific ways to torture the inmates of the camp. And not that much is known about Brendonk, because most people are focused on, rightly, the six mass killing centers of Europe, Auschwitz, of course, being the most famous. So Brendonk was not that. There were no gas chambers at Brendonk, but yet hundreds and hundreds of prisoners died from starvation, you know, malnutrition, being overworked, being exposed to the elements in which they were forced to be slave laborers, mostly for just ridiculous projects that the Nazis wanted to torture them with.
Zikaron lemasei vereshis ki hu yom tchilo lemikroi kodesh zeicher litziya
Yetzias Mitzrayim.
So in a paper you wrote titled Brindock, Austerlitz, and the Architecture of Memory, you invoke writer W. G. Sebald, whose novels use photographs of actual places to provoke feelings and lends historicity to his work. He wrote a novel called Austerlitz.
Yes.
And in it, he talks about Fort Brindock.
He does. Yeah, Austerlitz was his last novel. He tragically was killed in a car accident shortly after, and that novel got quite a lot of acclaim in the West, in America and elsewhere, and I don't think he lived to see all of that. He died shortly after its publication.
Would you mind just reading Looking Down the Long Corridor?
In W.G. Sebald's novel, Austerlitz, he writes, "Looking down the long corridor, down the center of Brindock, like a spinal column, is like a descent into oblivion, rather than a spur towards memory, towards commemoration."
And this was the feeling you had when you began interviewing your grandfather.
It was. This is precisely the feeling I had when I began interviewing my grandfather about that long hallway and what transpired behind the heavy oak door of the room labeled Business Room at Fort Brindock, a perfect example of what Raoul Hilberg calls the verbal concealment of the Holocaust. And for me, it was also so redolent of their actual hallway in Queens, my grandparents, because when I was a little boy, I would stay there with them. And they had this, for me, which seemed like a very long hallway. In retrospect, it's probably not terribly long, but it seemed endless to me as a little boy. Because in that hallway were several paintings and photographs that were hung on the wall. And there was first a woman, then there was a young man, a boy really, and then an elderly man as well. And I never knew who they were. The only thing I thought was that the middle one was a picture of my father. And I always wondered why my grandmother had a picture of my father between these two strangers on the wall. And I must have been, I don't know, 5 years old, 6 years old, when she saw me staring at that picture and asked me, said, "What do you look at?" And so I said, "I don't understand why you have a picture of my father here between these two strangers," which was probably not the right thing to say to my grandmother. And so she said, "That's not your father. That's my brother, Yisroel. Your father's named after him, but that's not your father. Lulu, we called him," she said. And she said, "Nabuch, the Gestapo, they killed him. The Nazis killed him." And I said, "And who's this?" And she goes, "That's my mother. The Nazis killed him too." And then she points to the third one. "That was my father. The Nazis killed him also at Auschwitz." And then she said, wait, sit." And she ran into the room, and she came back out, and she put these things in my hand, which I had no idea what they were. They looked like little pieces of walnuts, almost. And they had this little tissue paper around them, and she took each one out carefully and put it in my hand. And she said, "You know what this is?" And I said, "I don't know." She says, "Those are the teeth. The teeth of the babies and the young children in the orphanage that I took care of during the war. They didn't have anything to eat and their teeth fell out. They didn't have enough milk and many of them died of malnutrition." And then I'm like five trying to make sense of that. Her parents and her brother were just murdered. Now I'm holding literally in my tiny hand these tiny teeth. Then she starts waving her finger in my face. "So you shouldn't pour the milk so fast in the breakfast cereal. You wasted some this morning," she says to me. Here she is, you know, and she saved these things. Imagine what it meant to her to not be able to save all of these children and doing all that she could. It really explains an awful lot about my grandmother.
We're listening to Jewish scholar, Professor Ezra Kapel, talk about his new project, Letters from Brindock, about his grandfather's internment in Fort Brendock prison camp in Brussels. We'll be back in a moment. Let's rejoin our conversation with Jewish scholar Ezra Kappel as he talks about his grandfather's internment in Fort Brendock prison camp in Brussels.
Yom HaShishi Vayhulu HaShemayim Vohores V'chol Tzevom Vayichal Elokim Vayom HaShvi Melachto Yasher Oso Vayishbaz Vayom HaShvi Mikol Melachto Yasher Oso Vayvorech Elokim Es Yom HaShvi Kadesh Oso Ki Vayishuv Es Mikol Melachto Yasher Bore Leim Lato.
I got in this camp. The Gestapo picked me up among a whole group of Jewish people, mm-hmm. who were on the train, on the railroad from Antwerp to Brussels. Mm. And under the railroad, mm-hmm. they picked me up among those young people. I was about 15, 16 mm-hmm. years old. And they took me to the Gestapo and held me and didn't let me go.
Well, so this new book project I'm working on called Letters from Brendonk tells the story of my grandfather during the Holocaust, and it also tells the story of the larger family. He was from a large family of a brother and several sisters and elderly parents. It's the story really of their survival. And my grandfather's story is one that was never really told to his own children. You know, my grandfather survived the Holocaust. He married my grandmother, had three children. They moved back to Belgium after the Holocaust, where my grandmother had first my uncle, Sylvan, in 1946, then my father in 1947, then a daughter, I think like 1950 or so, Aunt Evelyn. And then when they came to America in 1950, they came over to America. They had a fourth child, Uncle Mitchell, who was born, I think, in 1955. And so the story, though, of the war years were something that was never really told. There was parts of the stories that my father and his brothers and sister had known, but they never knew the whole story. There were large parts of the story, let me say, that were obscured and actually buried or erased from the family narrative. And most importantly to that was the story that my grandfather had a fiance when he was sent to Brendonk concentration camp in 1941. But because of being Jewish, of course, and also his anti-Nazi and his political activities, his Zionist activities, he was known as a leader in the community in Poland. He had been a leader of Mizrahi and Bnei Akiva, which are these religious Zionist organizations. And he was very active in this and anti-Nazi activities, and was eventually arrested and put in jail and then sent to Brendonk, which was known as a punishment camp or torture camp, actually.
I was arrested, you know, I was held, and they kept me in this Gestapo hands. Mm-hmm. Now, they kept me there for, I think, overnight. Mm-hmm. It took me overnight. And then in the morning, mm-hmm. after the whole night, which was a sad night, and, mm-hmm. they took the young in a truck, they took the young Jews. I was considered a young man, mm-hmm. in they delivered us to the Gestapo.
Mm-hmm. You know, everyone knew that this was an awful, horrible place of, maybe they didn't know exactly the full awfulness of it, but you can imagine that it was known, well known, what this old fort was being used for.
The Gestapo, there was not Hochness. The Gestapo was mm-hmm. very extreme. The Gestapo has a kind of a basement, mm-hmm. where the Jews were kept. They make us run, mm-hmm. on the hallway, mm-hmm. without having idea why and what and where we go, mm-hmm. and we were being pushed with sticks, mm-hmm. and be running, with orientation. We had to find out that what they want, and that they want to bring us to a court. And the court was that was the reception place for the Gestapo. So I was kept in this court. I was beaten very badly, but they took us out in the hallway. In the hallway, they put us next to the wall. The wall, the punishment of the wall is we were standing with our faces to the wall, and behind each one of us Jewish boys was a Gestapist, was behind, and he was hitting us in the head, and we had to stay for hours. This lasted till late in the night.
So Dori Lob, in his book Testimony, suggests that in being a proper listener to the trauma of the Holocaust, a person can become a sort of participant in the drama. That the two people, victim and listener, are united in the storytelling.
Dori Lob himself is a child survivor of the Holocaust, and he has gone on to have a very distinguished career as a child psychologist who specializes in helping children survivors of torture. And he set up a center for that at Yale University. And what he's saying in that passage, I believe what he's talking about is the ways in which trauma gets transmitted. Survivors of torture and trauma, it is deeply important to know that there is somebody who listens, someone who understands what they went through. It's like almost a physical relief for them, he speaks of that, having someone that could hear your story. Because one of the things that happens while you're being tortured, and you can only imagine what this is like being in a Nazi concentration camp, let's say, which you're shut off from the rest of the world, is this helplessness, right? This idea, and John Omri speaks of this, that at the first blow, he says, when you are being beaten, he says that trust in the world is leaving. But at first you're like, well, somebody help me, and you're screaming for somebody to help you. And after the second and third blow, you begin to realize very quickly that there is no one who will help you. In fact, these people are here to hurt you, and that is what this is about. And there's no one who will help you at all. And so you are completely, utterly helpless, and nobody cares about what's happened to you. And so you are literally alone in the world. And so for people who have survived that experience, Dori Lob talks about how important it is to know that there is a human being out there, even years, decades later, that can hear your story and actually is pained to hear it and becomes therefore a sharer in your story in some way. And actually, he says, participates in it.
We were beaten all the time. And this lasted, this reception ceremony, this lasted the whole day. The whole day till late in the night. When finally we got after beating near the wall, we were liberated by this tailor, and we got a uniform. The uniform consisted of all the Belgian soldiers.
From World War One. Uniform.
With shoes which didn't fit properly. And that's how we spent the whole day. In the morning, we will beaten. The punishment for the morning, I told you that they were scraping my head with this stick of wood. This was one of the slight punishments to make pain. That was the SS was scraping my head because he found that my head was not clean enough. He didn't find it not clean enough for, for the German aesthetics.
Brendonk was known as a horrible punishment camp, otherwise known as a torture center, actually. And they would try to extract information from prisoners there. And one of the rooms that actually, you can see it online, if you go to the Brendonk website, you could see that door. And it's labeled the business room at Brendonk. And that was the torture chamber, really, where they did unmentionable things to my grandfather in that very room. And so if you think about that, what is the business of Brendonk? It's the business of torture, the business of inflicting pain. And so that was a pretty obvious example of what Raoul Hilberg was looking at throughout his history of the Holocaust.
After the scraping in the head, all kind of punishment, water washing, you know, we were admitted to the camp. The camp was the officers, there were officers, Gestapo officers. Actually, there were two, I told you, there were two authorities in Germany. There were Gestapo and was Wehrmacht. So we fell in the hand of the Gestapo. And in the Gestapo, we were, the main role of the Gestapo was to beat us. To hit us. This lasted till the morning. In the morning we were a few officers from the Gestapo was called and they had to assign us to work.
During my interviews with my grandfather back in 96, 97, 98, those summers I was interviewing my grandparents, my grandfather told me about how Commandant Schmidt basically would train his dog to attack the prisoners and how my grandfather was attacked by his dog and other awful things that were done to him as well. The room is intact. The torture implements are there on display. The means of torture, they're all there. And Fort Brendonk is now a museum, and I imagine they take school children from Belgium to go see what happened there. And of course, it's only recently now that Belgium as a country is starting to perhaps reckon with its own history of collaboration with the Nazis. How many of the SS were Belgian citizens who signed up to help with that? And to think about that, a larger percentage of the Jews of Belgium actually did survive than in many other countries. And some of that was due to Jews being more aware of what was happening and also not wanting to be rounded up when the Nazis rounded them up. They felt the precariousness of their situation. Many of the Jews in Belgium were non-citizens of Belgium. They had been Polish Jews and from other countries that had sought refuge there between the wars, as how my grandfather ended up there. But still, many people did, in fact, help hide Jews. Many Christian families took in Jews and helped hide them during the war. But Belgium as a country has not really, until very recently, acknowledged its own complicity in the rounding up of their Jews. And many, many tens of thousands of them ended up meeting their deaths in places like Mechelen and Brendonk and in Auschwitz, where they were, most of them were sent.
Mekoyer habruchu, meroish mikeder nesichu.
You've been listening to part one of Letters from Brendonk. To hear part two, go to artsandlettersradio.org.